NPR broadcaster Diane Rehm's husband, John, was 74 when he was diagnosed with Parkinson's. 9 years later, he passed away, having made the difficult choice to end his extended illness by refusing to eat, drink, or accept medication. In her book, On My Own, Diane advocates for the Right to Die movement that is all too slowly, she says, gaining ground in our country, as well as giving us a poignant look at the immediate aftermath of losing a spouse. She writes about all of this in the book On My Own. Diane Rehm hosted the Diane Rehm Show on WAMU in Washington, distributed by NPR from 1979 to her retirement this past December in 2016. It is a great pleasure to welcome Diane Rehm to the roundtable this morning. Diane, thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks so much.
Well, first of all, let us talk about how retirement is treating you since it's been a few months. How does it feel?
Listen, the word retirement is not in my vocabulary. I have transitioned from doing the daily show called the Diane Rehm Show to now doing, number one, a weekly podcast called On My Mind, working part-time in development here for WAMU, speaking out around the country about the right to die, speaking out about my book, which you've just mentioned. I am busier now than perhaps I've been in a long time. The major difference is that I no longer have to get up at 5 in the morning. I can now sleep until 7, and that's the best part of it.
Given what is going on in our world, do you miss that day-to-day contact with the listeners? You had great contact with your listeners on that program. Do you miss that aspect of it?
I do miss that telephone call-in, and you're absolutely right, that daily contact with listeners. I do not miss the pressure of having to get to that microphone at 10 a.m. every morning and to work very, very hard to work with my producers to get a two-hour program on the air every day. Having done 10 hours a week for 37 years, it was not only time for me, it was time for those listeners to hear a fresh voice, fresh ideas, a fresh approach. And so I feel very, very good about having made the decision to step away from that daily microphone when I did.
I'm curious about this as a talk show host who has a three-hour daily show. I wonder, at what point do you... Now, I've been doing this for 20 years. So at some point, when does the question start cropping up in your mind of, you know, as Jack Parr famously said, I feel like I've said all I've had to say twice. Do you get that feeling?
A little bit. Yeah, the people change, but the issues keep coming up and coming around. My decision really had been made a few years back. Both my late husband and I had decided that when I turned 80 years old, that would be the time when I would step away. John did not really agree with me and said, you know, you could keep on going. But I felt very strongly that the audience needed a new approach. I did think long and hard about it, but then when my new boss, J.J. Orr, came in and we had our first conversation, I said to him, and I think I was 77 or 78 at the time, I said to him, now, JJ, what you must understand is that I am going to step away from The Daily Show when I turn 80. And I turned 80 on September 21st, and my last day on The Diane Rehme Show was, I think, December 29th.
Right.
And then the new show came on January 2nd. So I feel good about it. I'm having such fun with this podcast. And believe it or not, before I began this podcast with two of my wonderful producers from The Diane Rehme Show, I had never even listened to a podcast. So it's a whole new world for me, and frankly, that's exactly why I love it.
The name of the new book, as I mentioned, it's just out in paperback, and it's entitled On My Own. Your husband, John, was 74 years old when he was diagnosed with Parkinson's. He passed away 9 years later. At what point did you know you wanted to write about it, to share his story?
You know, really funny, because on the night that John was dying, I was there at the assisted living place with him in his room next to his bed, lying on two chairs with my little dog, Maxie, on my stomach. At 2 a.m., I knew I couldn't sleep. Nobody can really sleep on two chairs. So I got up. I had my iPad with me, and I started writing. And I wrote about what I was feeling, what I was seeing, and how angry I was that John Rehme had to die this way, suffering for 10 long days, having decided himself that he would stop eating, he would stop taking medication, he would stop drinking water. He made that decision, he said, because it was the only way available to him. Because of Parkinson's, he could no longer feed himself. He could no longer bathe himself. He could no longer stand alone. He could no longer walk 3 steps by himself. So, in fact, he was totally confined to his bed. He could do absolutely nothing. He had hoped and prayed that the doctor would allow him to have some medication to, as he said, put him to sleep. But of course, that was against the law in Maryland, and he could do nothing but cease all food, cease all medication, and cease drinking water. And you may know you can live for quite a long time without food, but you cannot live for more than 10 days to 2 weeks without water, because the organs begin to break down. And so John chose that path, and we had talked about it, and I asked him again and again whether he was really sure that that was what he wanted, and his answer was absolutely. So that's how he died, and that's how I began writing this book.
Those 10 days where you are there and you are seeing this, and of course you're aware of what is happening, there has to be an anger that grows in you each day that leads you to ultimately, all of these days later, to want to continue to try to change the laws and to allow people to understand that right to die movement.
Absolutely. And I do want people to understand very clearly my personal position on this. If you believe that God should be the only force in your life deciding when and where you should die, I support you 1,000%. If you believe you want every medical treatment and medication that medical science can offer to help keep you going, I support you 1,000%. And if you want to die, when you believe the time has come for you to make that next journey and to relinquish your life, I support you 1,000%. In other words, what I am trying to say is that I support choice at the end of life. I support the right of people to choose, and they must talk with their families. That's really the other reason I wrote this book, is because people are afraid to talk about death as being a part of life. And we all know we're going to die sooner or later. So what I am urging is that people talk with their parents, talk with their children, talk with their friends, talk with their doctors about what it is they want at the end of life. Don't wait and leave the decision to others. Make sure your wishes have been made very clear and that you are getting exactly what you want.
When you're talking about this, you talk, as you do in the book, about this being John's decision. But I'm sure, given the long marriage that you had input, didn't you?
Oh, we each talked about what we wanted. I had done as he asked, which was to have our daughter, a doctor, on the telephone, our son with us in the room, his doctor in the room, and me. And it was at that point that John said to the doctor, "I am ready to die. I am ready to begin the next journey." His daughter from Boston on the phone said, "But Dad, we can keep you comfortable." And John's response was, "I don't want comfort. I am ready to die." It was after they all left and Jenny had hung up the phone. The next day I came in, not knowing yet what his decision was. I brought with me a photograph album I had made for him years earlier, from his birth in Paris to his graduation from Friends Seminary in New York. I sat on his bed with him with my arm around him, and I looked at him and I said, "Sweetheart, you look wonderful." And he said very firmly, "I have begun the journey." He had had no food, water, or medication that morning. And my question to him at that moment was, "Are you sure?" And he said, I am absolutely sure. So, of course, all of us had input into this decision. But the discussion between John and me had begun years before. We had both lost all of our parents. He was an only child. I had already lost my only living sister. And we talked about what we wanted. And neither of us wanted any extenuating treatment. Neither of us wanted to be kept alive if something disastrous should happen. And we each had the other's power of attorney. We totally trusted each other to make the decision that we wanted and go along with it. Now, mind you, at one point during that 10 days, I mean, I thought to myself, I could give him a little touch of applesauce, or I could put a few drops of water in his mouth and waken him and say, please don't go, please don't go. But that would have been totally against his own wishes.
The word you use is courage, and it certainly seems apt. You say that you don't know that you would have the courage to do what your husband did.
In the way that he did it, I think that that was a long and how do I know about pain? I mean, he never exhibited pain. But who knows what that journey is like? I would rather be in the hands of a physician who will allow me to have medication to take or not take at a moment of my own choosing. You know, in Oregon, where the first law allowing death with dignity was passed, only 2/3 of those who have received the medication from their physician have used it. And what that tells you is that just receiving that medication, knowing that it's there, is the empowerment that gives me the right to choose. And that's what I would like to have happen at the end of my life, when I can no longer function in a way that is fully life-giving and life-receiving. When I can no longer contribute to this society, I don't want to continue. So, you know, I am making my plans. I hope to God I live for a very, very long time.
Sure.
But if I should face serious illness, and I felt that the time had come for me to take that next journey, at least for now, here in the District of Columbia, we have that right. I hope the Congress does not attempt to undermine that right by taking away the authority of the District of Columbia. I know that you there in New York are debating this very issue.
Right.
And I do hope it comes to pass. I hope your legislators have the courage to understand that people should have their own choice.
You write about this in the book, but you became really an advocate in this issue almost by accident, because you were You were speaking at a dinner regarding Parkinson's disease. A reporter from the Washington Post was there, wrote an article, and then suddenly your bosses are alerted and ultimately come to talk to you and say that attending such dinners, which are for pay, they're obviously for charity, that it violates the NPR ethical standards. Look, we're all good NPR soldiers, but I know even for us, at least for me, I looked at that situation and I said, oh, really? Is that what they're going to worry about? it has to, after you've given your life to something and you want to do what you believe is right, and I certainly understand that separation of you and who you work for, but how do you look at that? I mean, you must have been disappointed.
I was. I was definitely disappointed. The top brass of NPR came up here. My boss, J.J. Yore, was in the room along with my producer and my program director. And there must have been 8 people from NPR who were here talking about the fact that they believed my advocacy, my public advocacy, which, as you said, came about by accident. I wasn't even at that dinner to speak. It was simply a dinner that Pat Harrison of PBS, of CPB, forgive me,
right,
had invited me, and there were about 20 of us at the table that evening. And Pat asked each of us to speak about our own experience with Parkinson's. And it was at that point that I did stand up and speak. And you, as you correctly point out, a reporter from the Washington Post was there, which I hadn't even realized. And he came up to me afterwards and said, could I come and talk to you at the office? So when that article came out on the front page of the Washington Post with the headline, Diane Rehm becomes advocate for the right to die, I mean, I didn't know I was an advocate at that point, but I sure learned that pretty quickly. Now, as a podcaster, I am free to speak and do exactly as I choose. So I feel relieved of that burden. I, like you, felt it was, what shall I say, a little over the top in terms of the concern expressed by those executives as well as by the ombudsman. But nevertheless, I was not prepared to quit my job over that issue. They asked me to make sure if I did any future programs on death with dignity, that I make sure to state up front that I am a member of Compassion and Choices. I do believe in the right to death with dignity.
As we close our time together, I just want to focus on that word dignity because we haven't mentioned it yet, but it's such a part of what we're talking about, isn't it?
Oh, boy, it sure is. John Rehm was such a man of dignity, not only in his own behavior, but in his interactions with other people. There were so many people who came to his memorial service who talked about exactly that. The dignity with which he treated other people. And therefore, my belief that he had that right to choose a dying that afforded him dignity. He did not want to fall further into a place of incapacity. He did feel that that was undignified and wanted to make his exit sweet and loving and clear. And that's what he did.
The book is beautiful. It's entitled On My Own. It is published in paperback by Vintage. Diane Rehm, a delight to speak with you. I thank you very much for sharing your story and for the great work you're doing. Thank you so much.
And I thank you. You've been very, very kind. Thanks a lot.
Thank you very much. Again, Diane Rehm's new book is On My Own. It is published by Vintage. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.